from Akron, Ohio. This is episode 230 of On the Tropes. On this week's episode, we're talking about romantic stories and all the tropes within those romantic stories. As always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I'm joined by, in the corner with a license plate on the wall,
Eva.
In the corner that's blank,
sir.
And in the other corner that's blank,
and Kyle.
You're actually just, yours doesn't actually have a corner. Yours,
I have no corners. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to think of which one, who you were going for there.
Yeah. Well, I figure, Kyle always goes last. Yeah. Kyle always goes last. So it worked out either way. Whose idea was it to do romantic stories? Was it yours, sir?
I think it was mine. And I had just seen one of my favorites and I was like, oh man, we should do an episode for it. And then I realized that it was a much harder trope to come up with five for than I thought it would be.
Really? Like, because you didn't have enough or because you had too many?
I really struggled to get enough for this one. I actually had more than the five, yet I wasn't sure how much romance was in each one yet. We'll get to it.
Yeah. And there were some that I considered where the romance is like, it's also about, coming to terms with like yourself or like accepting who you are, things like that. Like I thought about doing something like Moonlight. But that I think is as much of like accepting who you are as much as it is like a romance between the two characters that we see over time. So,
yeah. And then of course the other thing, we couldn't find an actual trope for just romance films. Like they have, I think, a rom-com page that we settled on just doing love stories, romance, and kind of anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the romance genre spans a few, like the most common are like straight up romances that are more dramas. And then there's romantic comedies. Then I guess you could have romantic horrors, maybe.
What about the traditional romances about knights and chivalry?
Oh yeah, we got some of those. So, Eva, which of those like subgenres of romantic stories is your favorite?
My favorite?
Yeah,
I had a similar problem where when it came time to actually like pick things, I had a hard time even coming up with a longer list to narrow down. Can't say this is ever one of my favorite genres, and not even in a way where I would like. I was like one of those people who actively spurned it either.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of didn't see most of these movies.
Yeah, so I really am not typically a fan of romantic comedies. It's just there are a few that I think are done well, but it's a genre that's so easy to do poorly, and I feel like those are the ones that tend to get made more often and rise to the top. So it's really tough to go out and find ones that are good, but I do really like the subgenre, and it's not even like a genre, but the type of romantic story I like almost always are the unrequited love stories where things don't go well for whatever reason and the couple don't end up together.
Mm.
I don't know what that says about me and the kind of movies that I tend to like, but a lot of the ones I have on my list will fall into that. We'll fall into that genre.
It makes for more memorable movies, I think.
Yeah.
When the ending isn't just the Disney ending where they end up
eat each other.
Yeah, where the movie is going exactly where you think it should go. It's nice when you have it change up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What are some tropes that we encounter a lot in these stories, do you think?
I think the falling in love trope or like first night trope,
like or a meet cute too.
Yeah, I guess
I think that's one we've covered actually. I want to say
I don't remember an episode titled that.
I think it was a really long time ago. Maybe we never actually did it and just talked about it, but I feel like we have.
I remember talking about the trope meet cute.
Yeah, let me see if I can find it in the old in the vault.
Uh oh. Is it one of the books on the wall behind you?
It is. I have each of the books behind me is dedicated to a separate episode of the show.
Oh, I thought it was like you pulled one book out and the door flipped.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Well, yeah, that too. Yeah. There's a million ways to open the door because each book actually opens the door. It's not a good a hidden. Anytime
when,
someone
when
happens,
none of them are hidden. They're all none of them are hidden. They're all hidden.
Yeah, anytime anyone comes in here, they happen to pull one book and they're like, oh, how did I manage to find the one? They're all, I don't see Meet Cute on here. So maybe we have
a cover. You guys
this,
did like
a, what is this like trope?
Couples, a couple of like couples kind of tropes. Maybe.
Yeah, just
I think we did one where they're bad, like a couple that does bad stuff together. I feel like there was one.
Yeah, like criminal couples. I forget.
Outlaw what, couple?
Yeah. Outlaw couple.
That's right.
Yeah,
we did
yeah, all. Yeah. No, so meet cute is like what you see in a like the example that comes to mind is 101 Dalmatians when like the two of them are like pushed into each other by their dogs and they end up like falling into a pond together and it's like, oh, look at this cute meeting that they have.
Oh, I was thinking the burger that I had for dinner tonight would be meet cute, but it's the wrong different kind of meat. What about the trope? I don't know what the name of it is, but just like people who fall in love. Yeah. Kind of like that, just really quickly and really hard. Like they've spent a summer together and they instantly are like soulmates, basically. I don't know.
Yeah. One of mine that is trope like would be. That.
Yeah. Look,
I guess it's like, I mean, love at first sight isn't.
Yeah. I guess you'd be that. Yeah.
Yeah, like whirlwind romance. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, what else? So we talked to, or I mentioned like the tragic ending. There's also, I mean, I guess the obvious example is Romeo and Juliet. If you want to go like full tragedy, not just they didn't end up together, but they also ended up
dead,
not being alive anymore. Yeah, what are some other like ways that we see these stories end typically?
One of mine is like the reunited love. Is one that showed up on my list.
That's a good one actually. And I think is Moonlight going to show up on anybody's list?
It's not on mine.
Not mine.
Okay. That's one that I like, I wasn't sure how much it counted as like really the best romance because it's like I said, doing things differently, but that's a good example of like what you're saying, where it's these two people at different points in their lives, like when they're too young to actually like be physical, and then when they're teenagers and just like trying to figure things out, and then when they're adults and they've had like all these other, you know, stressors in their lives. That movie's so good because it hits all three of those things so well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are good types of stories because you also get like this epic scale of like you're covering huge portions of people's lives.
Mismatched Lovers is another one that shows up a couple of times.
Mismatched in the story or mismatched
the place once in a kind of like in like so you mentioned Romeo and Juliet, either family or
they
groups
are
at odds or yeah. They're from the wrong side of the tracks.
Literally the wrong side of the track. And, I was Lady Bird.
I was thinking you were gonna say more like unbelievable couples, like Kate Winslet and Jack Black and The Holiday. Just like a very very strange couple, or John Favreau and what's her name from
Sofia Vergara and
yeah and
Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, both of them. Like what?
Well, it's because didn't he write and direct that?
Yeah. But yeah, as far as like the endings, I think if the story is mainly about the romance, there's not too many different ways to ultimately shake it up. Like they either end up together, they don't end up together, or one of them dies, or they both die, I guess. But
yeah, that's pretty much all the ways that people, those are the only things that can happen to a person.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to get detailed, but.
Yeah, there's one on my list that I think the movie intentionally plays with that. You just mentioned one of the actors that's in it.
I was trying to think of a horror romance. The two don't end up together at the end of Cabin in the Woods, right? They're not interested in each other, right?
No, not really. I guess
I don't think. I mean, I know it, throughout the movie, it's definitely they're definitely not. But I wasn't sure if they shared like a moment at the end or not. But
I don't think so.
They're just kind of obliterated together, I guess.
Yeah. Well, among like along with the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody.
What happened to that director? See, I feel like that was a big movie. And
I think he produced Leftovers, but I'm not positive here. I got him pulled up. So he wrote World War Z. He wrote and produced The Martian, produced 10 Cloverfield Lane, produced the other Cloverfield movie. Oh, he directed Bad Times at the El Royale, which a lot of people really liked. I thought it was fine.
The Netflix Cloverfield movie?
He did the John Goodman and Netflix Cloverfield movie. So he did
Netflix one was
he was the producer on both of those.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was only the producer on both of those. So I don't know if that gives him a little leeway.
Yeah.
Man, unbelievable how like the swing between 10 Cloverfield Lane and then.
Did you see the Netflix one?
I didn't watch all of it.
Yeah, it's
pretty rare.
If I did, I remember starting it at least, and if I finished it, I don't remember it at all, and I might have just turned it off because it was like all in space, right, or something. I think.
Yeah. I didn't watch it. It seems like it got dumped. Movies now, or not now, but. Like before now, movies would get dumped by like being released in February at a time when you can put it in theaters and it's not.
But it was streaming.
It's not the summertime. So this was dumped onto streaming, and this was before now where like everything's released in theaters.
Yeah, was it also in theaters?
So it wasn't. It was supposed to be. And then they ended up just dumping it onto streaming, but they did it in like the flashiest way possible because it was right after the Super Bowl, so everyone was like, oh, this is so cool, it's coming.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, wasn't it a surprise? Like nobody even knew what it was until
it was one of those like out now or something. Like
I think it was
whatever drops.
Everyone saw it and they're like, oh wait, this sucks.
Yeah.
To be fair, again, I didn't see it. But I don't know that I heard a single positive thing about that movie.
Yeah. No.
There wasn't anything positive about it.
I don't even remember who was in it. Wasn't it it was the star of like the Swedish dragon tattoo?
Yeah, I think it's got a really diverse cast. Like they tried to hit every single ethnicity on the ship.
It was called the Cloverfield Paradox.
Style casting.
Was the paradox that they released it with this big flashy release campaign, only it was also being dumped. Let's see. Oh, yeah. This is a good cast. Wow. It's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, David Oyelowo, Daniel Brühl, Chris O'Dowd, Zhang Ziyi, Elizabeth Debicki.
Yeah, Zhang Ziyi. Yeah, I forgot the
series. That's a lot of good people in a stinker of a movie, supposedly. Again, I didn't see it, but...
yeah.
Eva, what are your thoughts on Cloverfield Paradox?
The most romantic movie.
Is that the one that they released it on Super Bowl Sunday?
Yes.
That's the only thing I remember about it.
It seems like that's the only legacy it has.
Which is something. I mean, if you think back in your life, how many other things can you think of that happened on Super Bowl Sunday that aren't Super Bowl?
Well, it's all
I can't even remember the, Super Bowl.
You were saying that February also was a weird month. Are there bad and good months to release movies throughout the year?
Well, yeah. Like you'll have like Thanksgiving and Christmas releases for big movies and then summer blockbuster movies. But nobody's ever seen a movie in all of February. Like not a person has ever gone to see a movie in February.
That is a complete farce.
Ghost Town and the theaters.
Horror movies are often released in January and February.
Well, yeah. So there are exceptions. Like Get Out was a big exception because that got put out in a time that it normally would be considered a dump, but it ended up being like this huge hit. But most of the time that's like, it's after the Christmas blockbuster releases. There's a lull, and that's where they put stuff that.
Mm-hmm. And the Oscar nominees are getting re-released at that time too.
Yeah, and this isn't to say that those movies are bad. To be clear, this is the movies that aren't going to make like
tons of money.
Yeah, they're not billion-dollar movies. So you can do. Yeah, I mean, they're probably going to be better movies on average, I would say. But I mean, that's all going to change now. I mean, like maybe 10 years from now, it'll be different, or it'll be back to that. But certainly in the short term and in the near foreseeable future, we're in kind of no man's land in terms of like film releases, because movie theaters are not doing great right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a couple of movies that have tried to, like, they're trying to just do theater only, like the Green Knight.
Green Knight tried, and it did not last because it made such little money that they had to release it on digital.
Yeah, where did they end up releasing it?
It's on iTunes. You can rent it now on like iTunes or I assume Amazon Prime.
Oh, it's just not streaming anywhere yet.
Not for free. You can rent it for the cost of a movie theater ticket and a half. I think Old, the M. Night Shyamalan movie Old, they're doing just like a standard traditional releasing it in theaters, and a few months later we'll put it out on streaming and Blu-ray.
Do you kind of admire that, or do you?
I do. I don't know that it's the best business decision, but it's
also M. Night doing it, so
yeah, you gotta
business stuff very well.
Yeah, you gotta respect that he's kind of like doing it all on his own. I haven't seen the movie. I've heard it's actually like solid.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure it's okay. I think M. Night, he's got a really bad rap.
Yeah. You gotta respect someone who's sort of going against the grain, and especially when the grain is Disney, you know. I never thought that I would be on the side of like Scarlett Johansson suing someone, but then she sued Disney and I'm like, hell yeah, get him. Should we, speaking of Scarlett Johansson, is she showing up on any of your guys' movies? Kyle, the chef?
No, but I've seen that I thought of, because a lot of mine are more scenes than the actual whole movie, was the relationship between Black Widow and the Hulk in one of the earlier Avengers movies. And I love how they had like way more chemistry than some of the other relationships that they tried to give these characters. But
Scarlett Johansson is a completely CGI creature.
Yeah, but like the way I forgot about the whole hand thing.
More chemistry than a lot of other people in the movie. Yeah.
Then they like do the hand thing, and then they like, I don't know, it was kind of cool. And I feel like in one of the movies they try to maybe date, but then it's just like swept under the rug really quickly.
Because he's the Hulk. Because it's like she's not really, does she live with Bruce Banner or the Hulk? It's kind of like the Hulk.
Yeah, it's strange. I've never read the comics.
And that's like my entire list is based on
chemistry.
I think we lost her for a second.
What's your whole list is based on?
It was going to be chemistry, sir.
Physics.
Was it chemistry? Recess.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Was the answer recess?
Can you guys still
algebra?
Can
you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you again.
Which school subject was your list based on?
Chemistry.
Okay. Let's jump into our list. Kyle, what is your number five?
I'm kind of doing a last minute adjustment. I originally had What If.
Is that allowed? Can you do that?
I think so. I don't do it very often, so I'm giving myself a pass. I watched What If and The Big Sick like really close to each other because I really love Zoe Kazan and I think she's like so cute. I think I might prefer What If. But I think it's a little more entertaining.
Are you talking about What If, the Marvel series?
No. It's her and Daniel Radcliffe get together, but they're like friends first and they try to make a friendship work and it doesn't work, of course. But I'm going to change it to the Big Sick because I think they do romance a little more unique in that she's in a coma for most of the movie and it's kind of him with her family, and it's not like he's being romantic with them, but the fact that he's willing to be so close with them, Camille Nanjiani, is also like kind of romantic. And I think that the cast is really great, and the chemistry of everyone's awesome. So,
And it's based
despite Zoe Kazan not being in it as much, I still really like it.
Yeah, and that's based on he co-wrote it with his wife, who Zoe Kazan's character is based off of. It's what actually happened to her. She had some kind of some systemic like juvenile arthritis variant that causes all kinds of systemic problems other than just joints. So she actually like was in the hospital in a coma for while.
They just had no idea what it was the whole time. But yeah, there's just a lot of really good moments with Camille and her family. And Eva, would be your number five?
My number five, I am trying to decide which bad example I want on here. And I think I'm going to go with, okay, so bad example that a lot of folks our age think is a good example of like, you know, like romance or plucky female character. And bad example, Disney's Beauty and the Beast. Better example, more fun to watch, Cocteau's Beauty.
Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. You were the one who got me to watch this ages ago. And
that was almost a decade ago. Can you believe that shit?
I know.
It's the
great movie.
Main difference besides the is the Beast not imprisoning
right
her.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Beast is he doesn't want her to see him. Like he hides and he like gives her things and then runs away. And especially when he's been hunting, he doesn't want her to see him with blood on him.
Like in smoke coming off of his body after he hunts. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
And I guess originally the fairy tale is supposed to be like a satire about arranged marriages. That we have a young woman who gets taken away from her father and her family and sent someplace really far away. She doesn't want to be there. Her father is the one who arranged this, and she's probably stuck someplace that she doesn't want to be because her dad makes bad decisions. You know, this guy that she's stuck with is not who she wanted, and he's hairy and unpleasant, but eventually it's okay.
Yeah, it's a very good movie, and it's like a magical movie, and I think it even though the Disney one has like people turning into household objects and then vice versa, just the practical effects that Cocteau uses, I think, give it the feeling of magic even more.
I agree.
So I love that movie.
It's fun. What's your number five?
My number five is Top Five, written and directed by Chris Rock, 2014. It's, I think, his best directorial effort. He actually did direct a couple other ones, I think, Out of My Wife and Head of State. Yeah, this is probably the most polished one. And it's probably the only romantic comedy on my list. Like, it's a straight ahead, very simple romantic comedy. He plays a aging comedian who is trying to break into like drama films. He's trying to do a movie about the Haitian Revolution, and Rosario Dawson is a journalist who's assigned to interview him, and throughout the process of like going around town and meeting his family and friends, they end up falling for each other. And it's just probably the most simple, straight ahead, normal film you could think of, as far as like everything you think happens in a romantic comedy probably happens in this, except it's, you know, the theme is Black entertainers. So it's got some people who have since died, like DMX is in it, Cedric the Entertainer. Yeah, it's got a lot of really good like moments, and the chemistry between the two is really great. And you know, it was cool to see Chris Rock actually do a drama film that really worked.
Yeah, it had a very, something about it felt very much like a French New Wave film to me when I saw it. There's something very like understated about how they talk to each other and kind of how the movie progresses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the scenes are kind of like the I hate to say, you know, cinema verite or anything.
Yeah,
just kind of like there. Yeah, they're just things that kind of just happen to them. And it's got really, and it was cheap, which I love any kind of like grassroots film like that. Nick,
Cedric the Entertainer. I don't know if you were saying that he is also in it or that he is someone. You said his name like right after DMX. But
oh yeah, he is actually still alive. Yeah, he's still.
I did double check. I wasn't sure if you were saying that he had died too, and I was like, did I not hear the Cedric the Entertainer? No,
he's still alive.
Yeah, no, he's still with us. Yeah, he's still working. He was in First Reformed a couple of years ago.
I think is it Tracy Morgan right before? Oh man, yeah, it's the same year as the accident. So
probably must have been right before.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Forgot about that.
Yeah, so it's crazy. Actually the last one of the last Tracy Morgan performances pre-accident.
Oh geez.
Wow. Nick, what's your number five?
My number five, I'm going with we all know and love Martin Scorsese. He only makes gangster movies. As we all know, he's only made gangster movies. So I'm going with the gangster movie, The Age of Innocence, based on the book by Edith Wharton. And it is about Daniel Day-Lewis plays a guy who is engaged to Winona Ryder, but he's actually in love with Michelle Pfeiffer. And the whole movie is just about like the sexual tension between them. And they're clearly in love with each other, but they sort of can't get together for a few reasons. He could leave his wife, but there's also like they're like quote unquote higher society. And Michelle Pfeiffer is also married, but estranged from her husband. So there's a lot of like cultural and social politics involved, and all the stuff is just like preventing the two of them from ever getting together. And a lot of the movie is also about how Daniel Day-Lewis's character like thinks he has everything figured out and he thinks he's so smart, and then by the end of the movie you're like, he's been a complete dumbass the entire time. Everyone always knew what was going on. He was never like fooling anyone. And it's great. It's a great performance from him. I really think it's like it's at least top five Scorsese, which is saying a lot coming from me because I'm like Marty super fan. So it's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, I would strongly recommend checking it out. It's Martin Scorsese directing Daniel Day-Lewis. What more do you want?
Sure.
Kyle, what is your number four?
I think my number four is probably just going to be my favorite romantic comedy. Despite it not being incredibly romantic, I'd say. And it's About Time with Rachel McAdams and Donald Gleason. I think the kind of twist that they do on that story is refreshing. And I also enjoy that they don't try to add any kind of fake drama between the two of them where they break up for a time and get back together or all that stuff. Like their relationship is steady throughout, and instead they just play with what he does with his power, and the relationship with his dad's just sweet. And yeah, it's great. Their chemistry is really great. So if you haven't seen About Time, you should see it because it's real good. And it's not like cringy or cheesy or anything. It's just straight up good. Eva would be your number four.
My number four is mostly just one scene out of a movie. Well, no, I guess that overall it is pretty romantic. And I think I mentioned it once before. Like we talked about, I think I suggested like a trope where somebody like rips off their insignia that signifies that they quit, that they've left that life. And it's River of No Return. It's, I think, Marilyn Monroe's maybe second to last movie, one of her last movies. It's Marilyn Monroe and Robert Mitchum and Rory Calhoun. It's a Northwestern directed by Otto Preminger. And there's
what's a Northwestern?
It takes place in the Pacific Northwest.
But, oh, so it's not—it's not like what the movie is about, or like how westerns are.
It has some western tropes. It has a lot of western tropes, but it takes place further north.
Okay.
And there's a scene where they get they're taking this raft up this river to try to get into town, and Marilyn Monroe's character falls off the raft, and they have to pull her out of the river. She's soaking wet and cold, and there's a scene where. They go in this cave and build a fire, and Mitchum's character tells her to, like, you know, hands her one blanket and says, take your clothes off and cover up with this blanket. And then he comes in with the other blanket when she's ready and, like, warms her up by, like, rubbing her arms and her legs. And it's a great scene.
How does that go?
Hmm.
I said, how does that go?
It's fine. I think she's like telling him a story about, like, he says something about like how fancy her clothes are. She's got them hung up on like a little clothesline. And she's talking about the last time she was in like a nice town where she could buy nice clothes.
Yeah, I love Mitchum. What is, does Rory Calhoun make you guys think of anything? Every time I hear his name, all I think of is the Greyhound episode from The Simpsons. Mm. When, Santa's little helper has babies and Mr. Burns steals them, and he says that the one can stand and it looks like a little Rory Calhoun. And when they get all the dogs to stand, he's like, oh, 25 little Rory Calhouns.
Is that the same episode as See My Vest?
Yes. Speaking of Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
Rory Best Calhoun makes me think of Motel Hell.
Of what?
Motel Hell.
I haven't seen, what is Motel Hell?
Oh, Motel Hell is a late 70s, early 80s kind of exploitation classic where Rory Calhoun plays Farmer Vincent. He owns this roadside motel and he's kidnapping people who travel too close to the place, and he buries them in the ground. The hotel is kind of like a little, there's like a restaurant too. And he's known for like this sausage that he makes at the restaurant. And there's a sign that says it takes all kinds of critters to make Farmer Vincent's fritters.
Yeah. He means people, right?
Oh, he means people.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I have given away some of the ending. However, damn. You know, if you're into that kind of thing, check out Motel Hell.
I'm on it.
Well, that took a big detour away from romantic movies that I didn't really intend. So what's your number four?
My number four, drawing on your comments earlier about arranged marriages. So Jon Snow and Ygritte from Game of Thrones. Mm. I think that a lot of the point of their romance is kind of as a contrast to the many forced marriages that we see on the show. I'm sure all of our listeners know what Game of Thrones is. Yeah, it's a fantasy series with a wall between, set in a medieval kind of world where there's a wall between the civilized quote unquote world and the wildlings, who are like kind of northern quote unquote savages. And basically, Ygritte's one of the wildlings, and she makes a lot of points about how in their society they're free to choose their own, like who they love, things like that. John's undercover as a wildling, and he like basically is falling in love with this woman in like a true kind of wrong side of the tracks Romeo and Juliet romance. And I didn't realize until this last rewatch that Kit Harington and
they're actually together, right?
I think they're married.
Married?
Yeah, they're actually a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember being like, wow, like the chemistry, Liz Leslie, between the two of them is really, it's really genuine. And yeah, they're actually a couple, which makes a lot of sense.
Oh, they're not married, but they've been together for a while.
I feel like I heard just recently that have you guys read the books at all?
Nope. I haven't read the books.
That that relationship's handled very differently, where it might not even be a thing at all. But I forget, I was talking to my friend Dave about it, trying to like dance around what happens to her. I think he said it's handled different, but it also might just straight up be that the books aren't even there yet. But I don't know. I don't know.
There's some more, like, from what I understand from looking at online, you know, mm-hmm. how does this compare to the books? I guess there's some uncomfortable elements of how they get together in the books, like,
okay,
because Jon Snow captures her along with, remember when they first meet, he's capturing her with the other Night's Watch members.
Is it another Beauty and the Beast thing?
Yeah, because of that, and supposedly the free folk culture, that means that they're married because, you know,
he caught her.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Which is wisely left out of the of the show. Well, like, usually those kinds of quick romances don't make a lot of sense, and they're they usually annoy me a lot. Thing I want is when you look at the characters, you consider where they both are in their lives, it makes a lot more sense. They're both really young. They're both, as Ygritte mentioned, they're both soldiers in an army. You know, it's and I think that this recent rewatch that's hit me a lot more, just the conflict between the Seven Kingdoms and the Wildlings is like kind of, it's an ongoing long scale war. Mm-hmm. And she kind of makes this point that like they're commanding officers and they don't care about them. Like, and kind of stresses all they have is each other. And definitely in a situation like that, I can see two young.
It's a little Romeo and Juliet-y. A little bit. As far as like...
Yeah, there's a lot of Romeo and Juliet elements. Like, yeah, like Tristan and Isolde and like the whole, that whole, all those tropes are really present.
Yeah.
Nick, what is your number four?
My number four... So I talked about Moonlight a couple times, and since I couldn't put that on my list because I thought it was as much of a like learning about yourself as it is about the relationship between these two people, I decided to put Barry Jenkins' follow-up to that, If Beale Street Could Talk, on instead, which I think is a little bit more romance-centric anyway. So this is... a romantic drama based on the book by James Baldwin, and it features a young couple played by Kiki Lane and Stephen James. And it's about it's two people who've known each other like pretty much their whole lives, like you've alluded to. And then they fall in love and get together and they have a kid. And of course life gets in the way and, I think a way that is still quite timely, where he's falsely accused of raping a woman, and he's convicted in part because of a cop who just doesn't like him. I think if I remember right, it's like basically a knowingly false testimony. So it's about not just their relationship together, but also how their relationship meets all these challenges with like the criminal justice system and those various prejudices, and how these two people manage to still get through it, both because of like their relationship together, but also the family support they have. The movie, I remember the opening shot to this, and I've only seen it once, so I haven't seen it since like 2018 or whenever it came out. But the opening shot is of the two of them like walking down the street, and I think she's wearing a blue shirt and a yellow cardigan, and he's wearing blue and yellow also, or maybe the colors are switched, but I remember they're both wearing blue and yellow and they just match so perfectly. And like, just from that visual key, you're like, all right, these two, it's sort of like what Kyle was saying about time, how it's not going to do some stupid, like force them. Yeah, force them to separate, force them to break up for a little bit or some dumb reason. Like, you know that they're just going to be in sync, regardless of the crap that they have to deal with going forward. So I absolutely love that movie. If people haven't seen it, check it out.
Got to rewatch it. Like, I remember I basically watched it while programming it So I didn't really watch it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. You're busy working well.
Yeah. So I want to actually sit down and watch the whole thing again.
My number three is, I keep flipping my two and three as if it's like a really definitive list. I think my number three is going to be Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and kind of the understated relationship between Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh's characters. Mm-hmm. I was young when this movie came out, so I was really only paying attention to the fights. And those are kind of like the standout of the movie overall. But I think when you kind of look more into their relationship, it gets pretty heavy. But I rewatched the last scene between them, spoiler for a movie that's like 20 years old at this point. But when he's poisoned and she's telling him to save his breath and meditate instead, he says like with his last breath that he loves her, and it's just like horrible but incredibly,
yeah, good. That's a great love story on film because it's like unrealized, right? Like they never,
yeah, they never do anything,
actually have it. And they, it's not because of them, it's because they're so busy with their own,
yeah, and
duties.
I looked into like their past as characters, and I don't know if I think it's talked about in the movie, I just didn't really pay attention, but they've always really been interested, but they have a friend that's a mutual friend that they don't want to like dishonor by being together, so it's like an honor thing. But yeah, it's him saying that he loves her and that he always has her right before he dies, and that's just like horrible, crazy movie. Didn't think it could get any better, but it's still getting better like 21 years later. Eva, what would be your number three?
Number three. I think I also mentioned this when we were talking last episode we did, when we brought up romance movies, and I brought it up because of its depiction of people smoking cigarettes in it. And it's Now Voyager, starring Betty Davis and what's his name? Paul Henreid. There's this iconic recurring motif where he puts two cigarettes in his mouth, lights them, and then hands her one of them. Betty Davis is a character who's, when the movie starts, she's about 30 years old. She doesn't look a day under 45. She's very, very unhappy. She's the youngest daughter. She's home with her mother, and her mother's basically treating her like, she's going to be a spinster. She's going to stay home and take care of her mother. And her mother tells her like, that was the only good thing about having a child is when her mother was as old as she was, is knowing that this child she was going to raise to take care of her and she would never leave her. And so her mother like actively like picks out ugly clothes for her to wear and is really emotionally abusive to her. And she's really miserable. One of her sisters arranges for her to start seeing this psychiatrist who's played by Claude Rains. And he wants her to go on this cruise. And she goes on the cruise. She gets a new wardrobe. She's happy. She's kind of pretending to be somebody else. She has like a different name that she booked the cruise under. And that's when she meets Paul Henreid. And the movie takes a turn that I don't really appreciate, where she like sublimates the way that she loves him into like taking care of his daughter for him. Like the daughter comes to live with her and he comes and visits occasionally or something, and they have this like chaste relationship, and it's okay because they both love Tina so much. And at the last line of it, the line at the end that's so memorable is she says, let's not ask for the moon when we have the stars. Like, let's not even talk about us being in a relationship together because we'll just both take care of this kid, which is kind of a disappointing thing, but I like the story overall. The costumes in it are really great. She does the thing where she loses her glasses and she's instantly prettier. And she also pulls, rather than like when we were kids, the like dowdy female character would let her hair down to make herself prettier. Betty Davis's character starts wearing her hair in a pompadour, which makes her neck look very long. She wears a lot of very nice V-necks, look great on her. It's often on like the Over the Air Movies channel. And if it's on and I catch it, I can't not watch it. Sir, what's your number three?
So my number three is from Takeshi Kitano's movie, Sonatine from 1993. And it's probably one of my favorite. It's not a romance film at all, yet there is a romance between two characters that's like one of my favorite in film history ever. And basically the story is that Kitano plays this Yakuza boss that is sent to one of the smaller beach islands in Japan to like mediate between these two rival Yakuza clans. And one of his lieutenants and one of the like small town Yakuza clans, they're kind of paired up to spy on the enemy and do different things like that. And part of the whole Yakuza culture is this like hyper masculinity, and whether it's like resisting showing emotion or showing pain, anything like that. And the movie is kind of a deconstruction of that. And two lieutenants end up in like a queer romance together. And it's like not ever like really explicitly said. I actually had to look it up and see, like, is this something that has ever been acknowledged in the film? You know, there's a few articles and pieces on it. And it's just like a really, it's a lot like Moonlight in that there's that constant air of like repression, yet the characters are struggling to kind of like find ways to show that they're attracted to each other, that they have some like sense of connection. Like, you know, at one point, one of the characters, Ichi, has like a doll, like an action figure that he's kind of suggested with playing with, and they end up like they're playing on the beach together, and you know, the rain, they have a great scene in the rain, and it's just a really cool like window into repression. Just a quick romance that isn't, I don't know if anybody here has seen the film yet. It's
I have,
of course. Yeah, I mean, no, it doesn't really go well for, nothing goes well for anybody in that movie yet. It actually doesn't have anything to do with what, like, they don't meet a bad end because of their romance or anything.
In fact, in none of his movies does it end well for anybody. The relationship between, like, when you brought that up, I thought you were actually going to say Hanabi or Fireworks, because the relationship between B. Takeshi's character and his wife is also like, it's pretty fucked up, and it has like, that movie goes to some fucked up places, but the relationship between the two of them is actually kind of sweet in a way. I think she's sick and can't speak or something like that. So they never like, even like, they almost never, I don't think she talks at all. And he almost doesn't ever even talk to her. So it's just like them two goofing around and hanging out. And that's a really sweet relationship too, in the midst of a profoundly fucked up movie.
Yeah. Fireworks is pretty rough.
Yeah. I thought it was great. It's one of my favorite movies that I've seen this year. It's awesome. Yeah. Cool movie.
Nick, what is your number three?
Yeah. So, this is a movie that I watched for the first time last year. And are you guys familiar with the website They Shoot Pictures?
Yes.
So they just recently published, they did a poll where like anyone who wanted to submit could submit 25 movies. And then they took all of those votes and aggregated them and made a top 1,005. So I submitted 25 movies to that list, and the newest one to me, or actually the second newest one to me, that I've seen was a movie I watched for the first time last year. And it is a movie from 1945. It is a British romance drama called A Brief Encounter. It's directed by David Lean, the guy who made like Dr. Zhivago, Lawrence of Arabia. This is not like a big broad epic the way those are. This is a much smaller thing based on a short play. by the playwright Noel Coward, and it's about a woman. She's married. She's got a couple kids, and she's out one day, and a piece of like dust gets stuck in her eye, and she's at the train station. Some guy comes up to her. He gets the dust out because he's a doctor. They get to talking, and they end up like grabbing lunch together or something like that. And he's married. He has kids too, and they basically instantly fall in love. And it's about the tension between the two of them wanting to be with each other, but also, you know, not wanting to be, especially her, not wanting to be unfaithful to her spouse. And what's interesting about the way this movie's told, and I don't think I've ever seen anything do this before. So there's a narration in it, and usually narration, like in noir movies, narration is, you know, Fred McMurray, like saying, yeah, I did this. And then I did this. Or in Age of Innocence, the narration. So like noir would be first person narration. Age of Innocence, the narration is actually like the voice of the author, basically. So it's third person. In Brief Encounter, it's second person. She's the narration is her imagining her telling her husband, like confessing to him how she met this guy and how she acted when she was with this guy. And I've never seen anything like that before. It's like the coolest way to tell a story, that she's doing this confessional narration, but she's not actually saying it out loud. She's just imagining saying it. So it's a really good movie. I've watched it a couple times since then. And I'll definitely recommend it. Kyle, what is your number two?
My number two is just the married life scene from Up. I just love what they do with the music and the lack of dialogue, just images and quick cuts and showing this marriage and the ups and downs of it. And it's, you don't need them to say anything to know exactly like what they're feeling at any given time. And it's just really great. And I know that movie's not romantic at all, but that is one of the best, like really one of the best scenes ever. So I feel like it has to be mentioned. I don't know if there were very many romantic scenes back when, like during silent films, but I'm just always impressed when I watch this, what they can do without saying anything. Eva, would be your number two?
My number two, I just substituted in because I can't believe it just popped into my head. I had completely forgotten about it. And it's Wild Zero. Have any of you guys seen Wild Zero?
No. Yeah, not for years.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it too. It's really hard to find, it seems. I don't know what the deal is with the like streaming rights to that. But gosh, it's probably like 20 years old now, ain't it?
Yeah, from 99.
Gosh, even more. Japanese horror-ish movie, but also in the way that, like, kind of almost like a drive-in movie, because it's got rock and roll and a romance story and aliens and
what?
Explosions. And so Ace is the, like, protagonist, and he has this relationship with the Japanese jet rock and roll band Guitar Wolf, where they kind of appear as his mentor, kind of like in True Romance, but better. And there's this moment in the film where Guitar Wolf appears and admonishes Ace for that he's being kind of a coward, and they tell him that, you know, love doesn't know any boundaries. And just basically do it, rock and roll.
It's true. I found a Blu-ray copy of it on Amazon for $25.
I'm surprised it's on Blu-ray. That's kind of encouraging.
It looks like it's a Region B Blu-ray, so it's presumably a Japanese disc.
Mm.
Oh, and it only has German subtitles. Well, there you go.
It's an interesting combination. Sir, what's your number two?
You know, and this one was hard for me because I think I've talked about it a lot on the show, and Yeah, and I haven't seen it in a while. So I'm kind of wondering how it'll actually hold up when I watch it again yet. Eternal Sunshine on the Spotless Mind. I'll throw that on here. Because I think the thing that's best about it is I don't know what other film manages to capture what's good and bad about relationships.
Yeah.
As well as that movie. Like we talked about the only, there's only a few endings that a romance can have. Yet I think Eternal Sunshine has an ending where, spoilers, they're basically back together in the end. Yet you know as the viewer that they're not going to stay together. I feel like.
Yeah.
Like because we've seen everything that already can go wrong in that relationship and that will go wrong. And
it's
it's
like oddly like a downer
actually end up together
ending despite them being together. I don't, yeah, it's weird. It's a weird combination.
Well, it does leave it a little bit open-ended. Like they're back together and the question that the movie kind of asks is can you really ever get a clean slate? And if so, are the things that drove them apart circumstantial, or is it inherent based on who they are? Are they just fundamentally incompatible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess you're left to grapple with that on your own. But I think the more common reading is yours, which I haven't seen in a long time, but I would agree with, like, they're probably not going to work out.
Yeah. And so what's the nature of the love, the infatuation that they have for one another? Is it, and can we say that it's valuable, that it was good, even if they don't end up, even if we don't think they're going to end up together permanently? Like, I think few films like really have as many questions about relationships and give as much thought into it as that one does.
Yeah, I remember the first time I watched 500 Days of Summer, I really hated Zooey Deschanel's character. But then I rewatched it semi-recently within like the last year or so.
And you hated Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character.
Well, their relationship is not good, like really at all. And I don't know if it was just like the state of mind I was in when it first came out of just like, I don't know, just thinking everything should be romantic and happy. And I don't know. It's weird seeing that movie at two different times of your life, how you read it. But yeah. She's not so great.
I think that's very much your own experiences or your own mindset shapes how you see those characters.
Yeah.
Kind of like Colossal.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's some people who caught on to Sudeikis' character very early, Colossal faster than others.
Yeah, it depends
on how you grew up, I guess.
Yeah, that was hard. That was one of those like moments working at a theater where you're like, man, there's a lot of uncomfortable conversations that week. It's like plenty of people would walk out, like plenty of guys and stuff. God, I don't know. The problem is Jason Sudeikis is fine. And I was like, whoa, yikes.
He gave her his TV or a couch or whatever it was.
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah, he forced a lot of stuff on. What's your number two? Or Nick, what's your number two? I'm the wrong direction.
Oh, my number two. What is my number two? My number two is also a movie that I put on my They Shoot Pictures top 25 poll. It was on when we did ages ago our top 10 movies made in our lifetimes. It was on my list then. And over time, it has become like definitely a top 10, probably a top 5, possibly a top 3 movie of all time for me. And that is Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. This is from the year 2000, and it is about Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung play new neighbors. And they find out that their spouses are having an affair together. And it is about the friendship and then love that the two of them form together following that. And the story's great. It's got two of my favorite performances. It's one of those movies where people would say, what's your favorite lead actor performance, and I'd say, oh, well, one of them has to be Tony Leung and In the Mood for Love. And what's your favorite lead actress performance? And I would say, well, it's maybe Jenna Rollins in A Woman Under the Influence, then maybe Maggie Cheung in the Mood for Love. And what's the best use of color in a movie? Or what's the best use of music in a movie? Or what's the best non-requited love story? Or like, what's the best ending in a movie? And this always comes up, is one of my picks for everything that people ever give me. It's everything except like funniest and scariest. So yeah, it's an incredible movie. It just got a release from the Criterion Collection. It's astounding, and it's one of those things that gets markedly better with each continued watch. I've watched it every year for the last few years, actually, just because sometimes I'll start thinking about it and I'll just keep thinking about it. And I watched it a couple months ago. It's an incredible movie. Kyle, what I think you guys came over one time and I just like made you guys watch the very beginning of it, didn't I? Or did I do that with mom and dad? Maybe.
I think you did it with mom and dad. I know you did it once when you were showing off your new projector. I think.
Oh, I remember what I was thinking of. I did do that though. One time we were in San Francisco and we were visiting my aunts and they were saying, we were talking about movies, and my one aunt said that she likes action movies and Marvel movies and things like that. And my other aunt said she likes more like drama, more serious movies. But Sam, who's our cousin, who's I think like, how old is Sam? Like 23, maybe?
24 or 5, I think.
Okay. This was a few years ago. So he was maybe 22 or 23. She said, I like serious movies, but I can't go as far as Sam, who likes a lot of like these weird artsy movies. And I was like, oh yeah, like I like that kind of movie. They said, yeah, there's this one that he showed us that was just like, there were so many shots that were just of curtains. And I was like, oh, is it In the Mood for Love? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, oh my God.
They love shooting curtains.
Well, like the costumes, the set design, that like maybe the best costumes I've ever seen in a movie. Just everything about this movie is chef's kiss. I love it. Kyle, what is your number one?
Speaking of movies that handle music really well and unrequited love, The Falling Slowly, love that song. Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova. Rewatched another scene in that movie where he just finds out that she's married and her husband doesn't live where she lives right now. And he asks her how to say, do you love your husband or something like that.
Yeah, do you love him? I think.
And check. And she responds and you don't really know what she says and he doesn't know what she says, but she actually says, I love you. Or yeah, do you love him? And she responds with, I love you.
I think the translation of it that I saw is actually, it is you that I love.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I like better, but yeah. So this became a Tony Award winning play. And we saw the off-Broadway version of it. And when she says that to him in the play,
do they show it?
They actually, they subtitle it with like a light up, at, like an Ada Joe's type thing or something like that.
That he can't see?
That he can't see, but so the audience can see. And I'm like,
I kind of like it more, but I mean, now that I know it's not like, it's one of those things where you kind of wish you could witness it for the first time, like again, I don't know. Cause it's like, once you know, then it's less surprising, but it's still sweet that he has no idea. And it's not as obvious. Like, I don't know.
Something
on Wikipedia, it does say that she says, "I love you." But the translation that I saw had it, "It is you I love," which I think is more poetic. Yeah. But either way, like that, that it doesn't give you that translation, I think is so much better than
it being right in your face.
Yeah. It's like at the end of Let the Right One In.
Does he need Morse an excuse, though? Kiss.
And I just love the way that music is used to really like kind of bridge the gap between them. And the way they meet is through music, and the way that they kind of communicate is through music. And it's just so, so great. Have we done a music episode yet? Music movie episode?
I thought we'd done Meet Cute, and we haven't done that. So who's I don't know why you're asking.
We did it did like you mean ex- well, I can't think of the name for did like in what's
oh
yeah
diegetic two music. Terms
too. Yeah, but it'd be yeah, it'd be an excuse for Nick to talk about Inside Llewyn Davis for like an hour.
So. Oh, I could. I don't.
But yeah,
the year is 1963. Llewyn Davis is playing the song. What is he saying? What is the first song? It's not Dink's song. It's "Hang Me, Oh Hang Me."
Hang me. I rewatched the Falling Slowly scene though, and that was the song that was playing on the harp when Lisa walked down the aisle, and it definitely got me a little bit. Just like watching it and listening to it, it's great. Eva, what's your number one?
My number one, I picked not exactly a Romeo and Juliet, because Romeo and Juliet were like similar classed people, just kind of like not allies. But one of those, you know, rich girl, poor guy kind of stories. And it has some of my favorite character actors in it. It has probably my favorite pop song of all time plays at least half a dozen times in this movie, it feels like. And it is the first, I believe the first starring role for Nick Cage, and it's Valley Girl.
I've never seen it.
There we go.
It's fun. It has, E.G. Daily, one of my favorite character actors. It has two character actors who are in Apocalypse Now. The main character, Julie, her parents are Frederick Forrest, who is chef, and Colleen Camp, who was one of the Playboy models in Apocalypse Now. And girl meets boy at beach. Girl's friends think he's not any good for her. Girl's friends think she should go back with the, blonde surfer dude that she was already with. Boy takes girl into the city to go to some like punk show. Romance ensues.
Romance. I thought about picking, have you seen Moonstruck?
No.
I thought about picking that, which is a few years later, but another Nick Cage leading rom-com, which is another great movie. So I need to check out Valley Girl, though.
I would avoid the Amazon reboot that happened last year. I heard nothing good about it. I didn't want it.
I will. It will be easy for me to avoid. Have you guys seen the movie Pig yet?
Nope.
I would recommend it. It's very good. I will sum it up as this. What if John Wick was very sad?
What if John Wick was one of them?
No, it was very sad. Was
the person or the movie?
The person.
What if instead of, I'm pretty sure he is kind of sad.
What if instead of angry, John Wick got sad?
It was the way your eyebrows flared when you said it.
Oh, man.
If instead of gun-fu, he makes people feel feelings.
Gosh, don't do that.
Speaking of, I've got a pig on my hat.
Oh, I should have worn my pig hat. Yeah,
the pig is on a surfboard.
That's cool.
Not really.
What's your number one?
I guess my number one in a second. Yeah, you already know it. Something about that reference to pig. And you mean the 2021 movie, right?
Yes.
It reminds me of, like, reading about it reminds me of the movie I just watched called Deerskin. Which is 2019 French comedy horror. about a guy that falls in love with a deerskin fringe jacket. And it's pretty good.
so that's why I just randomly watched that movie.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot better than you think it's gonna be. It's strange. So my number one favorite love story of all time on film is Dogfight from 1991, starring the late great River Phoenix and Lily Taylor. Phoenix's death prompted me to say that River Phoenix is dead. There are no more love stories. I think even as many times as I've rewatched it, I just recently rewatched it, and it still holds up. It's about a group of Marines who are on their way out to, they're about to ship out to Vietnam, and it's like right at the beginning of the war, 1963. And they get together to play like a prank where it's called a dogfight, and they're supposed to bring a quote unquote ugly girl to this bar, and then whoever brings the ugliest date gets to take the pool. They all put in like money for it. And River Phoenix brings Lily Taylor, and it's up. They end up like having a night together. They fall in love. It's a movie that, like, on the surface, of course, it sounds awful. Like, it's one of the most cruel. And that moment is portrayed really well. It's portrayed as cruel. It's portrayed as, like, really awful. And yet, the story ends up being one of the best, kind of, like, I guess, meet cute or beginning of a romance stories. And a lot of similarities to, like, what I said earlier about Jon Snow and Ygritte, and that they're both young people, which I think influences a lot of what they're, like, how they hit it off. And that they both kind of recognize that the other one is kind of basically isolated and in a widely repressive environment. That was the 1960s. So yeah, it's a movie that, like, I was really surprised. It was one of those that I watched again, and I was like, wow, I'm not sure how this is going to hold up. Like, there are no Black people in this film. There are no people of color, I think, at all. Yet, I also remember thinking that, being that it was 1963, I don't know how well or what they would have been able to portray for characters that had been more diverse. Yeah, even despite that, it's a really great movie. Really great movie.
Also has E.G. Daly in it.
She's popping up everywhere.
Yeah, E.G. Daly is the woman who wins the dogfight.
In a great scene. It's a great scene. Nick, what is your... Oh, also real quick, it has Brendan Fraser in it as well.
Who's... That guy's having a moment.
Yeah, he's having a moment. Definitely. Nick, what is your number one?
My number one is another movie that I voted for. I knew I saw her in something recently. I just watched Streets of Fire, mm-hmm. and she's got a very small role in that. But I was like, what did I see her in? I knew I had seen her in something. And she's a
watched Streets of Fire.
Oh, it was awesome. That movie rules.
So great. Oh my God.
And she's, of course, Dottie in Pee Wee's Big Adventure. Dottie of.
And she was the voice of
one of the Rugrats, right?
Tommy? No, Chucky.
I think Chucky. Chucky. Yeah, but Dottie famously of I'm a Loner, Dottie. A Rebel. My number one was another movie that I voted for in the Issue Pictures poll. It is my favorite movie by the filmmaking team, Powell and Pressburger, and it is A Matter of Life and Death. This is a World War II movie where there is a British pilot whose plane is crashing. All his men have either jumped or are dead. It is on fire. It is actively on fire. He is going down. He radios to whoever's on land and starts basically hitting on the American girl who picks up on the other side, because, well, he's going to die soon. Why wouldn't he start flirting with her? He's very charming. It's very cloudy out. He crashes. He gets washed ashore, he gets up, assuming that he's in heaven and dead. And he is not dead. He's actually still alive. And he bumps into the girl and they fall in love. And then after they fall in love, an angel comes from heaven and he says, "Hey, we miscounted. We didn't see you because it was so cloudy and you should have been dead. So you got to come to heaven now." And he's like, "Well, you guys screwed up. So I'm not going to go because I fell in love after the time I was supposed to have died." And then they have a trial about it and they have a trial in heaven and it's incredible. And the movie does like the, I guess the biggest cultural touchstone for this is Wizard of Oz, where like the real world is in color and then heaven's in black and white. And you see them looking down from heaven a lot. A lot of the visual imagery from the Pixar movie Soul from last year is stolen directly from this, including the stair itself when this movie was first released. In the United States, it was released under the title Stairway to Heaven, and there's a very large kind of grandiose staircase that literally goes to heaven that we see. And it's ultimately about the sacrifices that people are called to possibly make for the ones they love. And it's incredible. I think it's the most romantic movie I've ever seen. It looks beautiful. And you can't watch without a smile on your face. It's very, very good. Have you seen it, Eva? I know you're like a Powell Pressburger person, or at least I know you like some of their movies.
Is that one also connected to Val Lewton somehow?
Not that I know of.
I'm mixing it up with something, I think.
Yeah. It doesn't have that feel.
I wonder if I just read an essay that compared that to one of Val Lewton's films. But to answer your question, no, I have not seen that one. That same motif where a person doesn't want to move on to the afterlife because they're leaving behind someone that they love is also comes up in a movie that I had on my list a while back, Between Two Worlds, the one where they're on a ship and they don't know where the ship is going. There's one character who is the secret long-lost biological parent of another character, and she knows what's going to happen and she doesn't want to tell anybody else because she doesn't want to die. She doesn't want to move on because she doesn't want to leave her kid.
Yeah, it's a good movie. And like I said, if you saw Soul and like sort of like the world that movie creates, I would definitely recommend checking this one out because it's the original recipe and it's better. It's a good movie. So those are our romantic stories. If you've got romantic stories that you like, you can write them in a handwritten letter, put it in a bottle, throw it in the ocean, and it'll find its way to us if it's meant to be.
Serendipity.
Is that what happens in that movie?
It's kind of about fate, right? Whether he believes in fate or not. I forget if he actually does, but I know that they split up, and if they were meant to be together, then something that they signed, she like wrote a number on a dollar bill or something, and he was going to find it.
Insufferable premise.
Is Kevin Costner in the Message in a Bottle movie? Who's
that? No, that's a song by the Police.
Police. Message in a Kevin Bottle.
I thought there's not a movie about it.
I'm sure.
There is, and he is.
Isn't there like, yeah, it's like one of those like almost Christian.
Ooh.
Yeah, I was going to say it's based on a Nicholas Sparks novel, who I don't recall this, but apparently I called for a fatwa against him when he visited the University of Akron.
That sounds like a movie that should make it into our jar.
No.
No.
I'm okay with that.
That's right, yeah, because he did A Walk to Remember 2, which is the other...
Wait, A Walk to Remember 2?
...romance film of our time.
A Walk to Remember?
No, he did that as well.
A Walk to Remember is a treasure.
A Walk to Remember?
This movie's...
Two Walks to Remember.
This movie's 2 hours and 11 minutes long.
aren't all Nicholas Sparks movies like longer than average?
Oh God, why? They're all going to be stinkers. Just like crap out some 86 minute piece of shit. It'll be way faster
and be cheaper to make.
Yeah. I don't know why everyone needs to make their movies so fucking long these days.
You say that as being
the biggest. So long with them. I mean, the last.
Aren't you the biggest Scorsese and Tarantino fan ever?
Yeah, well, they need to.
Just for 3.5 hour Hungarian horse movie.
Hey,
it's for horses.
I have no follow up to that. Yeah, that's what they eat. Oh, I thought you asked. What do we just see the horses eating for 10 minutes at a time?
Every time Charlie walks into a room and says, "Hey," I say, "It's for horses." And I try to do that enough to bother her. Yeah.
Right.
And also, I'm hungry. Nice to meet you, hungry. I'm dad.
Walk to Remember is pretty short. Notebook is over 2 hours. Let's see what Dear John is. Dear John is 107 minutes.
P.S. I Love You. Was that also?
Nicholas Sparks hasn't had any movies crapped out in a little while.
He's probably making like Trump propaganda films.
Yeah, it's been since 2016. So I don't know.
Checks out.
I feel like I'm winning here. All right. If you, like I said, if you got some romantic stories you want to talk about, throw them in a bottle. And if they're meant to be, they'll
throw them in a bottle.
As always, I've been Nick.
I've been Sir.
Eva.
And Kyle.
And join us again next week. What are we doing? Miscellaneous stuff.
Something.
And a game. Ha!
Cool.
Oi, you just done been listening to Onotropes podcast, didn't ya? Recaps. You want recaps? Get yourself to tvtropes.org/podcast/onotropes for your bloody recaps. Feedback, don't make me laugh. Send it to onotropes@gmail.com, don't ya? Or check out Facebook or Twitter. I'm not going to tell you where. You're a smart kid. Figure it out. That said, you want some gear what fell for Laurie? Come to onthetropes.redbubble.com and we will do you a deal, my son. No questions asked. Or, if you want to drop us a few quid, go to patreon.com/onthetropes, mate. Cheers.